Welcome everyone to the Ontology Summit 2014 session 5 on February 13, 2014. The session today is Track D, Tackling the Variety Problem in Big Data. This is the first session in Track D. And Destin and I, Ken Butlowski, are the co-champions. And if you go to the introductory slide number 2, slide 2, the session will consist of my introduction, and then we will have three speakers, Eric Chan from Oracle, Nathan Wilson from the Encyclopedia of Life, and Ruth Durr, National Snow and Ice Data Center. Then after the three speakers, Anatoly Levenchuk will give an announcement about the Track E or hackathon. Then after that, we will have an open panel discussion when we encourage everyone to contribute to the discussion for this session. So slide 3, just a little history of big data. The recognition of the problem occurred at least in the early 1980s when it was originally called the Information Onslaught. There were some interesting aspects of it. Different fields experienced the problem at different times. The transition from scarcity to abundance is always seems to occur rather suddenly and by surprise, although people really should have been prepared. And so organizations really have difficulty coping with the transition. And perhaps it's no surprise that many organizations are still based on the information scarcity model and have yet to make the transition. Slide 4, the main characteristics of big data are the large amounts of data, volume, the rapid pace of data acquisition, or velocity, and the complexity of the data, or variety. Variety is what we're going to be talking about mainly today. It involves a number of different things, all of which are characteristics of big data. Individual data items can be complex. You can have both structured and unstructured data of various kinds. The data may have a very complex structure, even from a single source, and one can have multiple sources that you are merging. Going to slide 5, so after recognition that this was happening, storage and indexing strategies began to occur. What we now know as MapReduce, this was actually 20 years ago today, more or less. I developed this back in 1994. And there were also many techniques that were developed prior to that time and since then for handling variety, such as schema mapping, control vocabularies, knowledge representations, and of course, ontologies and semantic technologies, which is our main focus today. Now, what is the connection between these two? Well, surprisingly, there isn't that much of a connection. Very little collaboration and communication. We hope to change that with the Ontology Summit this year. Notable exceptions of very early work was very closely related, these two, starting as early as the 1990s. Slide 6, the potential of big data is really quite immense. I mean, it could address some really important social and commercial needs. That's because traditional techniques have been recognized as being inadequate due to cost, feasibility, and ethical concerns. And people generally and privacy has now risen to be quite prominent. And unfortunately, the variety problem is typically handled with rather ad hoc techniques. Going to slide 7, why would it be important to address semantics? Well, misunderstanding the data can result in invalid or misrepresented analyses. This has been a recognized problem even before big data. John Ioannidis, in an interesting paper, claimed that most published scientific research findings are actually false. There are many kinds of bias, and it's difficult to recognize them. And standard experimental procedures do not necessarily eliminate the bias. Now, Ioannidis had a lot of confidence that big data would help this, but it's really hard to say. Could big data actually make it worse? Going to slide 8. So what can ontologies do to help this? Well, here's a list of some of the different areas that could be amenable to ontologies and could help with big data. Today we're going to be looking at a number of them. The speakers are going to be emphasizing the annotation of data and metadata, provenance of the data, processing workflows, hypothesis generation, and the workflows for hypothesis generation. So it should be a really interesting series of talks today dealing with some really, you know, powerful techniques that could be applied to helping big data. But there's still some challenges, of course. As I said before, there's little collaboration between the communities. Big data tends to focus more on the volume and velocity. There's a tendency for many people just to assume someone else will handle the variety problem. There's also an issue of tooling compatibility between ontologies and semantic technologies versus the tools that people use in big data. And also an interesting incompatibility that people have recognized called a hybrid reasoning gap between statistical techniques that are used by scientists and big data analysts and the logical techniques that we tend to use in semantic technologies. Moving to slide 10, looking at this distinction, I would assert that actually there's no intrinsic incompatibility. The truth is that probability has been axiomatized, and you could, you know, give it a logical framework with a formal ontology, and one can represent statistical statements within such an ontology. And this has been done, and continuing work is occurring on this. There are a number of different techniques that are going to be used, that can be used in this area. One example is Bayesian networks that are especially powerful and often look a lot like ontologies. You know, they have diagrammatic techniques for representing Bayesian networks, and you can use the same techniques for developing them. On slide 11, I show a little picture to show what a Bayesian network, simple Bayesian network would look like. It can involve both discrete and continuous random variables. You see their relationships, and you see what looks sort of like classes. And you can even do, if you look, go to slide 12, inference, although perhaps querying is a little more accurate term for this. You put in some evidence, and then you can then extract from this Bayesian network the answer to your query. So in this particular case, you look at some symptoms and then try to infer whether someone has the flu or more precisely what the probability is for that person to have the flu. So moving on to slide 13, we're I have a little brief introduction to the speakers. The first speaker is Eric Chan from Oracle, who Eric and his colleagues, Dieter Goblick and others, have done some very interesting work addressing many of the aspects of the variety problem, including provenance, metadata, and this hypothesis generation and workflow for the, in particular, the OODA loop that he'll be talking about. Second speaker is Nathan Wilson from the Encyclopedia of Life, who will give us some experiences with using semantic technology in the Tree of Life, a taxonomy which is perhaps the oldest taxonomy of all, and it's a notoriously messy one. Moving to slide 14, there's Ruth Durr from the National Snow and Ice Data Center, who is going to give us some of her experiences using ontologies to address some very heterogeneous sources of data for snow and ice. I think a lot of these talks will give us insight into practitioners in big data and how the semantic technologies can help. So I would like to now introduce Eric Chan from Oracle. And Eric, welcome. And so we'd like you to begin your talk on the your insight into the OODA loop.
Yes. Thank you, everybody. I'm going to present on behalf of my co-authors and my co-inventors, Dieter Gorlick, Adele Ghanemi, Zhenhua Liu, as well as two other colleagues who have been collaborating with us, David Leeds and Ronnie Spelling, who we are all collaborating on research, user experience, prototyping, and use cases. The title of the talk should have been Enabling Enhanced OODA Loop with Modern Information Technologies. So we did make some fundamental improvements to OODA Loop. So let's go to slide number 2. There's a safe harbor statement. Let me explain that this talk is a solution architecture that is leveraging Oracle database, middleware, business intelligence, cloud, enterprise management technologies. It's mostly research and prototyping, and some of that is in collaboration with universities, and some development for internal operations. So this is not a commitment to deliver a product, and thus may not be incorporated in any contract with Oracle. So let's go to slide number 3. We have been working on the knowledge-intensive database model for several years. In a model we published 2 years ago, we had a triangular model, and we refined it recently to a rectangular model, and I'll show that to you. And I described this model to Ken and Peter in one of our ICOM PC meetings, and Ken told me that what I described was OODA Loop. So that was the first time I found out about OODA Loop. But we are very pleased, my co-authors and I were very pleased, that KIPP's model already have a mindshare in the form of OODA Loop. So we are using OODA Loop as a stage to promote KIPP's. OODA Loop is a pre-information technology process. John White formulated the OODA Loop after observing the behavior and strategy of fighter pilots in dogfights. He generalized it as a natural survivor's trait in the evolution of species. So it's very intuitive and appealing. So let's go to slide number 4. OODA Loop involves an actor observing the entities in the environment. Actor orient the observations for situation awareness using cultural tradition, genetic heritage, previous experience, analysis and synthesis. And then derive the hypothesis from observation to decide on the best course of action and act on the directives and repeat the loop with new observations. One of the important parts is that in applying OODA Loop in a situation involving adversaries, you want to run OODA Loop, iterate over OODA Loop rapidly, and you want to preserve the experience and propagate it to subsequent loops, subsequent iterations, and that's where provenance is important. In the case of fighter pilots, they conduct interviews to propagate the effective techniques in the missions. So let's go to slide number 5. Okay, KIPP's model is not just an IT solution for OODA Loop. We made fundamental enhancements to the OODA Loop. We formalized the complementary data and knowledge categories and an invariant structure of their interaction among data and knowledge. We define 4 categories of data, so that's why it's ontology. We have facts, information, hypothesis, directive, which are shown in red boxes. We formalize the 4 categories of knowledge that transforms the data, and these are shown in green arrows. Here, the classification knowledge involves deductive reasoning. So there is a natural classification of these knowledge functions by the fundament, the mode of reasoning in that activity, knowledge activity. So classification knowledge involves deductive reasoning. Assessment knowledge involves abductive reasoning or solving inverse problem or regression. The resolution knowledge applies decision theory involving subjective measure of cost and payoff. The enactment knowledge involves control structures. You can think of this as an engine from which you can generate workflows. If you are used to think of designing workflows for process management, this is where you can run through these loops to simulate the situation and generate a set of workflows to validate that this is working as you expect in terms of these workflows that you expect to derive from this paradigm. So let's go to slide number 6. So in the next few slides, I will describe the different aspects of the KIDS model. First of all, KIDS normalizes the data and knowledge into four categories of data and four categories of knowledge. Knowledge transforms one type of data to the next, and these fall in the designated slots. Also, KIDS normalizes the application structure. So you are developing program evolutionary application development, but they are following this invariant structure so that each of your components are going through classifying quantitative facts to derive the qualitative information and assessing information by regression to infer the hypothesis, resolve the hypothesis by applying cost and payoff and decision theory to formulate the directives or course of actions, enact the actions, and collect new facts and repeat the loop. Let's go to slide number 7. And in doing so, we need to represent the entity model of the world. And the entity model could be dynamic, so that we need to manage that in a temporal database, bitemporal or multi-temporal database. KIDS is a process management engine that proffers the interaction among actors, system components such as data transformation, machine learning, etc., and entities in the environment. Let's go to slide number 8. So KIDS is used to materialize OODA, CARE, or FIHT loop in the data to illustrate the provenance of data and knowledge evolution. And I have a slide later on that provide a proof point. So the annotation in the data can help with gaining insight to your operations. KIDS also enable evolutionary application development, where knowledge is application, and we want to specify the application as much as possible declaratively rather than procedural code. Data and knowledge are intertwined, and they represent the convergence of these two elements. So when knowledge changes, you want to reanalyze the data with new knowledge. When data changes, you want to recharacterize the knowledge. And a lot of knowledge is derived from data by machine learning. And it's amenable to graphical programming. Represent an invariant structure of applications. So that's especially suitable for graphical programming and metaprogramming. Let's go to slide number 9. So we start off with a concise description of GITS ontology in the next few slides. GITS is a fixed tuple. We have a list of set of actors and entities that they are monitoring. Actors are monitoring. The system itself, which is CARE, representing classification, assessment, resolution, enactment components, which include data and knowledge, the metadata, reification for provenance, and profile of actors and knowledge elements as well. So GITS data categories, we normalize the data in terms of feature or in that, you could also call that attributes. FSD here stands for flexible schema data. It could be unstructured data. That's especially relevant for big data when you want to have this unstructured data and extracting and recognizing structure in unstructured data. And once you extract the structure, they are represented in features, vectors, and so forth. And the information hypothesis directive defined in terms of feature of entities and valid time, temporal model is important, and the figure of merit, the statistical model is important. And here's a simple representation of valid time for each type of data. So let's go to slide number 11. Classification, assessment, resolution, enactment are knowledge, different classes of knowledge. They are just functions that map from one type of data to another. We define a symptom resolution because sometimes you don't need to always do hypothesis generation. You can go directly from information you have to a directive, so especially to solve the symptom before you diagnose the problem to find a root cause and resolve it in a deeper manner. So let's go to slide number 12. That's where we describe GITS also include tested knowledge representation. We represent tested knowledge by profiling the actors from their contributions to different social media or discussions and so forth. And using the actor profile, we can personalize the knowledge and different views of that data from different perspectives using actor profiles. And we formalize the personalization as a query operation that apply actor profile to the knowledge function that provide different views of the data. So let's go to slide number 13. GITS metadata model is basically a higher level program composition from components that are knowledge functions. So we model the input-output relationship among the functions so that we can propose the interaction among these knowledge functions or algorithms, and also among the actors and the interaction with the entities in the environment. So there is a specification of a program in the form of metadata using this model. So let's go to slide number 14. We also represent the reification of events or activities as the system evolves and progress. So we have a care loop that is a chain of classification, assessment, resolution, enactment activities. Each of that is captured in terms of the actor involved and the entity. Entities are part of these information elements and the transaction time. So we are using a bi-temporal model, transaction time and valid time. So let's go to slide number 15. So as I mentioned earlier, there is a natural categorization of knowledge representations based on the mode of reasoning. So classification knowledge includes algorithms that implement deductive reasoning, such as support vector machines, naive Bayesian network, neural network, clustering, association rules, and multivariate state estimation technique, MSET. Assessment knowledge performs abductive reasoning, and Bayesian belief network can support abductive reasoning, finding the root cause, giving the evidence, as well as least square optimization and regression to solve general inverse problems. So using the root causes that you can derive, then you can resolve using decision theory, and there are these algorithms for decision theory and extension of Bayesian belief network with decision nodes, which is called influence diagrams, Dempster-Shafer theory, decision trees, and there's one for prognosis of remaining useful life, which is, goes together with the MSET algorithm in the classification. There are also enactment knowledge that can be represented in terms of scripts, plans, schedules, go log, and people and BPMN processes. Let's go to slide number 16. So KITS normalizes the knowledge representation into care components, as well as the situation knowledge that is derived from entity model. And we want to emphasize that the entity model is dynamic, therefore we need a temporal database and a situation calculus using situation theory ontology. The entity model provides the insights to the system through the data, such as data cubes, dimensions, concept hierarchy, and I'll provide a few examples of proof points. Tacit knowledge profiling and user preferences and personalization. We did a presentation in to Ontolog some time ago. Zwu and I presented this tacit knowledge profiling with N representation using OWL and Sparta queries as part of the ICOM activities. We provide the tacit knowledge of Ontolog members using NLP and term extractions and so forth. And you can see the demo in the presentation. So it is a practical solution for representing tacit knowledge in the system. So here's a model scenario describing KITS use of information fusion. Here is entity model and KITS ontology and entity ontology combined. And KITS ontology involves information and feature and temporal information. And there are four types of information presented here: observation, objective, prediction, simulation. These are derived from different types of knowledge in the system. And we provide a fusion of these different perspectives of information, as well as fusion of information from different sources, like DOM0. DOM0 represents the host OS in a virtualization, and Oracle VM represents a guest OS, and a Java VM that run one particular service called Enterprise Scheduler Server. This is part of the scenario I will be developing later in the slides. So this is describes the information fusion we want to achieve. So here's a table that this represents the influence table that's part of KITS metadata. Using this table, KITS can propose the interaction among processes among knowledge and data types. It defined an input-output relationship between knowledge elements so that when a data input type is satisfied, and if you can match the entities in terms of fusion of these information from different entities, once you can match up true entity as a primary keys, then you can invoke this knowledge and keep the system running, keep the application running. This kind of data can be represented using R, but in the presentation, I'll be using UML to describe the scenarios, but it could very well be in R and RDF using Sparkle queries. So let's go.
Eric, five more minutes.
Yes, and the rest are the proof points, so I'm going to go through them more quickly now. So go to slide number 19. I'm emphasizing that entity model need a temporal database. As you know, situation calculus is a dynamic first-order logic system. It can leverage temporal database. Entity model, especially the domain I'm describing, Oracle Cloud, is dynamic. You are upgrading software. You are applying patches. You're always doing capacity, scale-out, and dynamic resource management, hardware upgrades. So it's a very dynamic system. So you need a provenance and a temporal model. And they are part of the time series that affect the system response to different loads and different seasons. Let's go to slide number 20. I want to emphasize that entity model is important background information because we are going to extract entities from big data. In this domain, we are talking about log data, and we are extracting entities, and we are extracting measures from these log data, and using measure and different dimensions, we can do OLAP operations for insight to the system. Let's go to slide number 21. Here I describe how entity model is used to extract entity identification of entities in the unstructured data, such as a log from a WebLogic server. So let's go to slide number 22. Here is an entity model shown in a UML diagram, and there is the concept hierarchy that you can derive from the entity model, and concept hierarchy are important for data insight. I will show that in a minute. Here's a dimension that you can define using concept hierarchy, and given the fact data and dimension, fact table and dimension table, you can define cubes and do different kinds of data analysis. So this is a one particular dimension, pillar dimension. Here's a pod dimension with concept lattice. All these are defined using Oracle DDL for dimensions. And then let's go to slide number 25. Let's describe the DDL for defining dimensions. This is a pod dimension as opposed to pillar dimension we saw earlier. And let's go to slide number 26. We are now looking at virtual and physical resources. Earlier, we were seeing logical components of application, logical structure of applications. Yes, physical and virtual and physical on slide number 26. On slide number 27, we have physical machines and entity model. So we have to incorporate all of that in the data schema for analytics. So slide number 28 shows one more DDL. And slide number 29 shows DDL for database resource dimension, the virtualization technology. So these are used to visualize different measures that you can gather from the big data logs. Let's go to slide number 30. GIS can be used to materialize OODA loop in data, especially in a data from cloud domain. The data include intelligent behavior, and you want to see that intelligent behavior. Intelligent behavior is composed of data, knowledge, and processes. Those are OODA loops, and you want to annotate that in the data. So you can see that in slide number 31. There are trends in the data, raw data, and you can see the changes caused by system changes, load changes, as well as seasonal changes. So, and that should be part of the data when you are for visualization. So let's go to slide number 32. So this is a conclusion. We presented KITS ontology, and basically our work is a solution architecture that is leveraging existing technologies in Oracle database, middleware, BI, data mining, knowledge engineering, enterprise management, social interactions. So we are trying to demonstrate that there is technology, and here's a sophisticated solution that you can build on top of these technologies. You don't need to write new applications to accomplish that. And you can use this technology to tackle the variety problem of big data, which involves significant amount of data, rapidly evolving knowledge. You need large-scale tracking of states, not just for data, but also for processes that you use to analyze. You need to involve social interaction and collaboration among actors. So that concludes my talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. That was very, very interesting. So now we would like to move to the next speaker, who is Nathan Wilson, Director of Biodiversity Informatics at the Encyclopedia of Life. So Nathan is going to be telling us about the Tree of Life and how semantics and semantic technologies are important in handling this very very interesting form of knowledge.
Great. So on starting with slide two, first one was just a title slide. My background from when I was very young as a naturalist and very interested in the natural world, I learned quite a bit about mycology, but from a professional standpoint, I went into software development, ended up working in industry for many years, including DreamWorks Animation, where I first got introduced to semantic technologies. I realized rather quickly that semantic technology was very appropriate for representing biodiversity information, and ended up creating a website called the Mushroom Observer, which actually was not driven off of semantic technology initially, but there are some aspects of that now. Through those, I ended up leading the technical team in charge of the Encyclopedia of Life, and I'm stationed at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, and the primary project is EOL. Moving to slide three, this is the homepage from EOL. As it states in big bold letters in the front, our mission is really to provide global access to knowledge about life on Earth. The EOL was created in part as a result of a vision from E.O. Wilson from Harvard, where he envisioned a website that would provide a page for every species on the planet. We've gone a long way down that path. There are some interesting knowledge representation issues along the way that I'll address, and then there's also sort of getting deeper representation of the knowledge about the groups of organisms that are involved. Let's see, moving to slide four, I just realized that this is a build. It was not intended to be that, but slide four, if you get the version of it that has the monkey visible on the scientific, titled Scientific Names, this talks about two of the problems in scientific names. One are homonyms for a variety of reasons. The formalization of scientific names has the potential of generating what are considered valid homonyms. So in this case, there's a monkey from South America and a pea flower from Australia, I believe, both of whom have a genus name of Aotus. This makes it challenging to bring information together in the context of EOL, since often information is associated with a specific name, and that name may be just a true complete homonym, or it may be a partial homonym, and trying to decide what's new information and what's and which slot it goes into can be quite challenging, and requires a fair amount of use of context and other clues, and sometimes simply can't be determined. The other big challenge with the scientific naming system are synonyms. For a variety of reasons, synonyms are extremely common in Latin names. This is one example. This little purple mushroom has at least this many synonyms that date back from Linnaeus, who I believe gave it the name Agaricus nudus, and to its current name, which is Lopista nuda. And since we're by and large digitizing or mobilizing historic data, understanding those synonyms along with typos and so forth is critically important to sort of organizing and synthesizing the information together. The other big challenge that scientific names present, the current scientific nomenclature, moving to slide 5, are what I call changing definitions. This slide shows two actually separate species that were originally considered to be one species. Latiparus sulfurius was the original name that was given to both of these. And when it was discovered that the description used for Latiparus sulfurius was larger, incorporated more than one species, the process for dealing with that situation is to publish a new name for the thing that is least like what was considered the primary representation of that name. So the species on the right is Latiparus gilbertsonii now. And the one on the left is still Latiparus sulfurius, even though there are older collections of Latiparus gilbertsonii that go under the old name. So the name, from a technical perspective, actually changes its meaning over time, which, of course, is quite problematic from when you're trying to integrate the information together. So EOL addresses these issues in a number of ways. To a certain extent, we are stuck with the scientific naming system as it currently exists, so we have to just deal with it. But there are some efforts going on to try to provide a better framework that things could potentially move forward towards. But that's another conversation. The way that we are primarily using semantic data, and so there's a big data aspect of that other information, but the way we are moving into using semantic data is really to represent what we consider to be traits. So moving to slide 6, this shows a search interface across a newly released feature in EOL, which we are calling Trait Bank. This shows some cell shapes for a group of organisms called diatoms. One of the things that you'll notice is both that it has the different sorts of information. Those familiar with semantics will see the natural subject, predicate, object type representation in a graphical form. It's a little more abstract than that, of course, because we need to associate things with the relationship itself. Those are in the form of the metadata down below, sort of at the bottom of that slide. That's the metadata for the second row in there. And one of the things that we're trying to be extremely careful with in EOL is provenance. Where did the data come from? Where are citations? How does the data relate to other data? And that sort of thing. Moving to slide 7, this gives you a quick overview of what I'm calling the trait bank architecture. So EOL itself is a Ruby on Rails, or includes a Ruby on Rails web interface which is sitting on top of several storage technologies, a Solar Index, and a MySQL backend for the original pieces. We've now added a Virtuoso Triple Store that's accessed directly from the web application. Both the MySQL database and the Virtuoso Triple Store get data into them from a backend harvesting mechanism that runs on a regular basis and talks to a very large number of data partners. Currently, we are getting semantic data from about 27 partners. We are getting data related to images and text from about 250 data partners. And those are growing and changing every day. We re-harvest data periodically and reintegrate it together in order to put it up on a page. Moving to slide 8, this shows the first hint, I guess, of the semantic data. Over on the right-hand side is an area of the overview tab that demonstrates some of the data. So there's habitat, body length, and so forth. This is a sort of snapshot of the data that is currently available for this for the California sea lion. You can click on the See All link there. There's a link across the top to show you what page I'm currently on. And I have dived into the demo section of this with slide 8. Next slide, 9, shows what we call the data tab. This shows the variety of data that we can provide. This is one section of the data that we have available for the California sea lion. If we go to slide 10, a little further down on this page, you would see something like the has-predator relationship, and you'll see that bull sharks are one of the species that eat California sea lions. You, through the interface at this point, you can go ahead and click on bull shark, and that will take you on to slide 11. And then if we go to slide 12, which would essentially be scrolling down that data tab, you'll see under the feeds on that we there have the California sea lion as a object of that relationship. The management of the URLs in this is largely done by the admins of the system. There's a interface that only admins have that those of us who are more interested in data and semantic relationships and so forth I thought would find interesting. It's not available in general. If we go to slide 13, it's the what we call the known URIs tool, which is only available to our admins. And it gives you the URIs for the information, labels associated with it, various type information, that sort of thing, along with actions that you can then take with those. We split our URIs into a number of categories. We have measurement categories, which this slide shows. If we go to the next slide, 14, you'll see some of the association information, which in many ways is the most interesting information, since it shows the connections between species as we had seen earlier. We can go in and edit these URLs or URIs within the web interface, making it available for our scientific staff. If we go on to slide 15, you'll see a bit of that editing interface that we provide. We do expect the people who are using this to have an understanding of URIs and that sort of thing, to be fairly sophisticated, which is one of the reasons why we limit the access to it. And if we go on to slide 16, you'll see this is where the relationship information between URIs are provided, and essentially we do a very small amount of inference. If we know that something preys on something, then we can figure out that that thing has a predator for it and vice versa. Slide 17 is actually an unintentional duplicate of slide 16. I apologize. Moving on to 18, this is a more this is a view sort of from the other angle of a particular attribute that's in TradeBank. In this case, body length. I'd mentioned that earlier with the California Sea Lion page. This shows all of the taxa for which we have body length that's currently ordered in terms of from biggest to smallest. You can change around the order and that sort of thing. You'll notice that it gives you a definition of that. It gives you the URI that we're representing that with. You'll also notice that there is an explore the data glossary option, which if we go on to slide 19, you'll see an example of our data glossary. Again, this gives some information about the URLs, the definitions, and so forth. You can add information to this glossary, and we provide a variety of ways of uploading data. So that's the demo portion. So now we will go back. Those of any of you not with the demo version, I think you can go on to slide 9 at this point, and we will go to slide 20. So TradeBank is a Virtuoso-based triple score, follows standard practice. We are using shared ontologies wherever possible. Here's a list of some of the example ontologies that we're using. The environment ontology provides a lot of information about habitat information, I can say that, right? The plant trait ontology is another well-known ontology for describing plants that has been under development for a while. PAETO, or the phenotypic quality ontology, is also another well-known one in the biodiversity world, along with units of measure. Some of the things that are, we don't necessarily use a formal ontology, but we use standard terms. So that's the case with Darwin Core. Finally, we found that in many cases, we have to simply generate URIs for terms that providers are giving us. Often they won't know how to go through that process, so simply to mobilize the data, we have to forge a new one. So that's these EOL schema terms, fruit seed color. We are hoping to catalyze communities to formalize that and take that on. We do have mapping tools so that we could transform these once they become more standardized and so forth. Moving on to slide 21, I wanted to mention some of the ways that people contribute to the Encyclopedia of Life. So most of our data partners provide us with names, images, and text. Information on that, if you happen to know folks that are doing that or want to do it yourself, is available on our info contribute page. Semantic data, we have not yet fully integrated into the documentation that we have on contributing, but it uses a very similar mechanism. If you go to our contact page, we can, and you have data that you're interested in providing, we can help you get you hooked up and figure that out. The fundamental core of how all of the data is getting into the system is a data format, which is the Darwin Core archive format that was developed by the Global Biodiversity Information Facility, and is being used fairly widely in the biodiversity world to share information. We've added some extensions to that in order specifically to support data, and all of our data is currently coming into the system using that. Moving on to slide 22, or I think that's 11 in the other deck, techniques for getting data. So the TradeBank system obviously has the UI that I demonstrated for exploration of data, but for large amounts of data, that's simply unwieldy. The first thing we've implemented for providing access to data is data downloads. This is the preferred way to get data as opposed to, say, a query interface or something along those lines for the scientific community. They tend to like to get their data and then chew on it for a while. One of the big advantages, of course, of data downloads like this is it's relatively easy for us to cache. On our side, we can spend some time processing to generate those downloads, and then the users can get them as needed. So moving on to slide 23, future development. So our current expectation is that we will continue to remain focused on downloads and expand that in some ways. The current download mechanism, I should have pointed out the button during the demo for doing downloads, it's straight off of one of the search result pages for TradeBank. The focus will remain on that, but a few sort of obvious features that we want to add in the near future are being able to get all attributes for a taxon. Right now, you pick a taxon and you pick an attribute, and you download that data, and also the ability to select multiple attributes. We wanted to get something out that had the minimum working set, and we'll expand from there. We do expect to provide interfaces for user-added data, but we expect that those will come along later. We're also interested in other ways of providing access to the data. Didn't mention that on this slide. One of the things we're looking for, particularly from a community like this, are ways that you would like to get that data. We've talked about things ranging from application API type thing for sort of sipping data, as it were. There's also the possibilities of various kinds of large-scale dumps of the data, since all of the data within EOL is available under open licenses. Although we do have a few content partners where it gets a little tricky, but generally we exclude that from our large dumps. So we can do that, and then there's also, of course, an option of providing some sort of Sparkle endpoint or that kind of thing. So in conclusion, I wanted to thank the Sloan Foundation, which was instrumental in funding the work that we did to provide and create TradeBank. The Marine Biological Laboratory has also been generous in their support for the project as a whole. As I should have also included the Smithsonian Foundation, Smithsonian Institution on this list. They lead the Encyclopedia of Life project. And finally, the developers and various members of the EOL team that were directly involved in the creation of TradeBank. So thank you all. I think I ended a few minutes early, much to my surprise.
Thank you, Nathan. That was really very interesting, and we actually do have a little extra time now. The next speaker is Ruth Durer, who is from the National Snow and Ice Data Center. She's a principal investigator, project manager for data management and cyber infrastructure, and she's going to be telling us about this National Snow and Ice Center, and particularly the way that semantics becomes very important, because you have such an enormous variety of data sources that have to be integrated in this database. So, Ruth,
thank you for that introduction. And I should say that. Yes, I work at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, and we do indeed have a very wide range of data, because we're funded by NASA, NOAA, and NSF. With NASA, we have satellite data. With NSF, we have everything to individual spreadsheets from investigators. So it's quite a wide range of data, but I'm not specifically going to talk about the larger National Snow and Ice data center holdings or activities. I'm going to talk pretty much about one particular project, which is called the Semantic CICE Interoperability Initiative. And before I get going, I'd like to say that when Anne was asking me if I would be willing to talk in this venue, I noted that I wasn't totally sure that I had anything relevant to say, and I suggested three topics, and she said that two of them would be good, and so the slide set actually covers two specific different topics that actually both fall under the SCI project, the Semantic CI Interoperability Initiative, but it's conceivable to me that I will only speak about the first one today, depending on how much time that I really have when going through these materials. So I should note that the SCI project is an NSF-funded project, it's an interop project, and that it's really a collaboration between the National Snow and Ice Data Center, which had been trying to somehow figure out how to get to learn about the semantic technologies, et cetera, and bring them into the facility for some time, but didn't have mechanisms to do so, and the Tetherless World Constellation, which is basically the organization that Deborah McGinnis and Peter Fox worked for, and who are experts in it and who are sort of in some way, I would call it, doing a little bit of technology transfer to the National Snow and Ice Data Center. So with that, move to slide two, which really just is an intro slide for this project. I thought it would be interesting for those of you who have never seen any sea ice to get at least an example of what it might look up like up in the Arctic Ocean. So this is actually a picture taken by one of our research scientists here at NSIBC. On to the next slide. So the intent of this project and is sort of threefold. I'm only going to talk about the second two of these, but they were the project's purpose is to actually to start developing a network of Arctic data and systems and to harmonize the metadata across those systems such that you could start to make these data more interoperable. And so specifically this project was to create sea ice ontologies and encourage their use across the communities in the Arctic and around the Arctic, and thereby hopefully improve the discovery, understanding, and use of sea ice data. So I'm going to talk about these second two points specifically. Please go to slide four. And the project actually was looking at the problem from a variety of different perspectives, because the Arctic is a large system that has a number of different kinds of interconnected problems and issues, and so it was deemed important to be able to start thinking about how to integrate all the various perspectives together. So there's basically four perspectives that we're taking a look at. The first is simply the operational perspective. Use cases would be something like when is it safe for a barge or other ship to get to a place like Barrow, which is on the north slope of Alaska. This particular image is from a news report talking about having to cut a path for a tanker to get fuel to Nome when they were particularly iced in and running low on fuel. So, so the operational perspective is one of the four major perspectives that we're working on. Another perspective is research in general. As some of you may know, or hopefully most of you may know, the Arctic is changing very rapidly, and one of the things that's changing is the sea ice in the Arctic. In particular, it seems to be melting in the late summer much more than it used to. And that's a particular concern because of exactly what you see in this picture, which is that when it melts, or when they're when the temperature gets warm enough that water pools on top of it, the albedo changes considerably. In other words, the water is much darker than the snow and ice, and that has an overall effect on basically the climate of the planet. And so there are questions related to what's happening in the Arctic and its impact on the rest of the climate. Typical question would be, how is this changing sea ice affecting the ice albedo feedback, which in turn affects weather and climate for the rest of the globe? So a research perspective is another one of the perspectives that the project is thinking about. The third perspective that we're dealing with is basically a perspective that's trying to integrate that research in the form of data, usually, into understanding and being able to predict then how that Arctic system, and in particular the sea ice, being what this project is concentrating on, how that is going to change in the future, how that is changing now, what data should be used to validate and drive those models that are trying to predict out into the future how things are going to change. So on to page 7. And then the thing that a lot of people down here in the lower 48 seem to forget is that there are actually, I wouldn't say a lot of people, but many people living in this area and who have lived there for many thousands of years. And so they have a perspective also on the changes that are happening. And in particular, they're seeing considerable changes to their way of life based on the changing climate conditions. To be exact, they're seeing that the ice breaks up earlier, it freezes up later, and I'm not talking about days, I'm talking by weeks, and that a lot of their traditional knowledge and forecasting abilities are no longer working as effectively as they used to, and so that means that many of their traditional ways of life are perhaps not as safe as they used to be, and because the sea ice will be thinner, it might not be as strong as it used to be, and so the things that they're used to doing in order to survive, because many of these people still live off the land, and so that has a major impact on their way of life. And there's a lot of stories I could tell you about that, having dealt with some of these communities for a while. But so those are the four perspectives we're trying to combine. We think that they all feed off of each other or should be informed by each other. And so the question is, how best can one go about doing this? Now, we held a series of workshops as part of this project, and the first workshop actually brought together representatives from each of the first three communities, the modeling community, the research community, and the operations community, to start seeing if we could understand what the issues are and between each of the communities and what each group really needed from the others. And one of the things that came out of that series of discussions during that workshop and follow-ups was on page 8, a recognition that there are some kinds of data that kind of bridge these boundaries between these various communities. And this is an example of one of those kinds of data. This is what they call a sea ice chart. Each of the countries that has shipping or boundaries on the Arctic Ocean has something they call a national ice center, or their local equivalent of that. and that it's the responsibility of that organization to monitor the sea ice that's important to that community or that country and create charts to be used for shipping. So boat captains or fishing boats or cargo ships, et cetera, would use these sea ice charts then to understand that some area has very thick multi-year ice that there's no way they could go through, but that other areas might have ice that's either thinner or broken up that they possibly could safely traverse. And so these charts, every country initially did them their own way, but many decades ago now, they started realizing that actually it would be a benefit to the broader community if they started using similar charting techniques. And so that's where this concept of an egg code came up. And an egg code are these little ovals you see on the screen that are divided into sections, and they point at some geometric shape on a map. And what they are doing is describing the actual ice conditions in that area. And so next screen, that's page 9. And the World Meteorological Organization then eventually got to the point where these egg codes were standardized around the world with all the various and sundry national ice centers. And so you can see what they are is an encapsulation of concepts or measurements about the ice in a particular area. They typically have the total concentration in tenths, in other words, 8/10 ice, in other words, 80% ice and 20% not ice, probably water. And that they have the concept of mixed characteristics within a region. For example, a region on an ice chart might be 80% multi-year, very thick old ice, and 20% small brash kinds of things that were created, you know, from breakup of ice and mushing and creation of new ice. So the way to read an egg code is that the numbers the furthest to the left indicate the predominant form of ice, and as numbers go to the right, then there are lower and lower percentages of ice of that type. So you might say, you know, 80% multi-year very thick ice, 10% first-year ice moderately thick, and 10% new ice, very, very thin, for example. So we have the concept of concentration, stages of development, and forms being basically how big are the chunks of ice in width, not thickness. So these egg codes are based on this WMO terminology. So NSIDC, it turns out, actually has a fair amount of sea ice chart data going quite far back into history. And actually, you can see the development of this egg code in our data over time. A lot of that data is still on paper form, so we've been doing our best where possible to find money to digitize it and bring it forward. But I should note that the global community actually has developed a format called SeaGrid 3 for actually representing these sea ice charts as digital data. And when I mean that, what I mean is that for each polygon on the map, there will be an associated shape in a shapefile that is attached to that shape or associated with that shape would be its associated egg code in a digital form. So next slide, page 10. So the first thing we did was, based off that understanding, is to try and move forward and get to the point where possibly we could take our CGRID 3 formatted sea ice chart data and make it available as OpenLink data. And that obviously was a fairly ambitious first step for a place that had no experience with ontologies whatsoever. But what we did was we thought about that for a bit and decided that the best way to proceed would be to develop a series of very small, or at least relatively small ontologies that were focused on various aspects. So the CGRID 3 ontology that you see in the upper left-hand column, that is an ontology that's all about data and the encoding of data. The ontologies you see down in the bottom, called the WMO Sea Ice Nomenclature-based ontologies, these are ontologies based off the World Meteorological Organization maintains a number of maintains basically a glossary of terms related to the physical characteristics of sea ice, its age, its thickness, its color, and other such attributes. And so what we did was we worked with the WMO and actually drafted a series of sea ice ontologies that basically encode the physical characteristics of sea ice using the terminology of the WMO organization. And the reason for doing that is that if we did it that way, then they actually were interested in maintaining those ontologies for the longer term. Now, connecting the CGRID 3 data ontology and the sea ice, WMO sea ice physics of, I guess, physical characteristics ontology is this egg code ontology. There's the joint committee, JCOM, is a joint committee of all the national ice centers of all the Arctic nations that have ice centers. And they maintain a series of documents and specifications about the egg code, and we're responsible for defining the CGRID 3 data format. And so the egg code is what links then these physical characteristics to the actual data. And on slide 11, which may not show up well unless you blow it up much larger, you can see that we've actually published on our website using the Manchester Ontology Browser all of our ontologies, and that because we anticipate that these ontologies will be maintained by these larger organizations for the longer term, we've taken some care to ensure that we've used versioning and provenance and those sorts of things when writing up the ontology so that they can be reused and maintained into the future. So, slide 12. So, if you think about it, what we're really talking about here is taking operational data and creating an easier way, for example, the research community to be able to look at it and use it. And so, what we're trying to do is to create that first open link data set. And so we've loaded our CGRID 3 many decades worth of sea ice data that we had in CGRID 3 format into a Virtuoso triple store, and that happened late last year. And so that's complete. And we're in the midst of developing a simple prototype query interface. I should probably have noted earlier on that while this project was funded, it was actually funded without any developer support. So if you can imagine that, the whole concept of trying to actually demonstrate something without any funding for developers is kind of an interesting challenge. But in any case, I have an undergraduate student that I've been using to help create these interfaces, et cetera. So he's in the process of basically using the Sparkle endpoint to develop a very simple query interface that at this point basically just comes back with a list of basically dates and shapes for where certain where the sea ice is meeting your criteria. And so these are the kinds of queries that you can use in that kind of a prototype. And that is, you know, tell me where the sea ice was thicker than, you know, 3 meters between these two dates. Or where were the ice flows larger than 10 kilometers on such and such a day? Or what was the average age of the sea ice in the Beaufort Sea during some period? So those are the kinds of questions that putting this data into a triple store, you can actually just answer rather than having to open every file and read it and write an algorithm. So,
Ruth, 5 more minutes.
Okay. So, the next steps here are to create a map-based query interface, and there are some experiments in progress. The reason for doing that is you'd like to be able to watch movies of where the ice is moving as a function of time. And then the real end goal here is to be able to then take this operational data and then use it in combination with our, for example, large satellite data and answer more sophisticated questions. And on to page 14. So the other areas that we're exploring then is how then do we connect this all to modelers? And so Sujota, who's one of the members of our team, has been spending some time working with the community ice code folks, which is the sea ice component of the community air system model, to help understand and model how that the components of that model interact with each other and what's parameterized and what's directly simulated so that you can get a better understanding then of how you can connect data to these parameters and to validation of the models. And they're using basically event calculus to do that. And the goal here then is to tie this all back to the existing set of ontologies. Last but not least, we have the indigenous perspective. And this is kind of an interesting thing in that they have a lot of knowledge and understanding of how sea ice behaves and how the systems are changing that have actually been shown to do things like improve modeling capabilities. So the question is, how can you capture that and pass it on? And what we're trying to do is to capture a lot of that by extending our ontologies into those languages. And so on slide 17, you can see some of the materials with which we're working. And I should note that we actually work with individuals in these communities on these and have discovered that the whole concept of concept mapping, like on page 18, actually is something that they understand very well and can help us with. And so this is just an example of a little bit of a concept map. Why is this important? Because we actually have a lot of data from these communities, and a lot of that data is textual, and it's not always totally in English. they may be using a native term, or they may be using a French term, depending on where in the Arctic they're coming from. There are other languages involved too. But so our data, it has this problem that it's quite often has mixed terms. And so if you're trying to query it and find all the data on some subject, you might have to use many terms, and it would be better if we had the ability to semantically query that data so that when they use one term, all of them related terms are also used in those queries. And you see an example of this on slide 19. But I also note that those communities are really concerned about losing their languages and maintaining the knowledge base that they currently have. And so we've considered in all of these applications then how one would go about using the semantics underneath to help them continue to train their communities while also helping us gather the data that we need. So that's on slide 20. And on slide 21, we note that one of the major concerns at the moment is that there's a lot of people studying sea ice up there and a lot of community members up there who no longer have quite the connections to the environment that the older generations have. And so there are many concerns about issues like sea ice safety, and that is one of the places where the WMO ontologies will connect to these native ontologies and help make help with sea ice safety training. So last but not least, then I should note that actually these communities are very interested in working on these kinds of projects. Here's a quote from Peter Katuk, who's a fairly major player in Sanikiloak. You know, it's time for the harpoon and the computer to work together, which is a very beneficial saying that was on slide 22. And on slide 23, then basically these are the benefits to those communities in general about why they want to do this. It's amazing to me that there are many people in the lower 48 here who are denying that anything is changing, whereas these people who are experiencing that change really don't understand that at all. In any case, as I expected, I was able to only cover the first of the topics, and I'm going to quit at that point. You have the slides about the work that we've done with schema.org, and you can you read them at your leisure. And I'm done at this point.
Great. Thank you very much. That was very exciting. So now I'd like to ask Anatoly, can you make a brief announcement now? We have so put up your slides.
Yeah. I like to do announcement of Track E hackathon. And slide 2, a mission of the hackathon is very simple, to have fun during one day international hacking event. Because All Ontology Summit have a fun of listening and speaking, but it seems to me slightly less fun than in doing something in a good company. And last year it was a very successful hackathon, and it was very interesting to participate in this hackathon. And it was very interesting results of this hackathon. many ideas that simply found in our Ontology Summit session. Some kind start to provide results immediately and discussed internationally, and this is completely another mode of activity. And I urge you to participate and try. This is very interesting, and you will not be disappointed. Next slide, please. The topic of our summit, the community that come together, it's reflected into our current hackathon. There is several gaps, for example, structured data gaps in data world, big data world. They have tables, triples, text, exotic data structures, and there is statistical reasoning in data world and axiomatic reasoning in ontology world, and we should have something to do with this, and we have ad hoc schema in data world and in semantic world most part, and we have heavy reusability intentions at least in ontology world, and we want but we are not too picky. We want that project that you suggest in this hackathon try to touch at least two of these gaps, not one gap, because all these gaps belong to one domain, one discipline, but at least two, maybe even three gaps. But it is very difficult, and we will not be picking, I promise you. Fourth slide. And now I loudly call for projects. If you want to do something with actual code, actual tool, maybe future tool, maybe future code, you intend to prototype something or brainstorm, or you have not code, but you have some kind of data set, or you want to draw something in data set or ontology set, or maybe even website, you are welcome. We have no restriction what you will do, but we urge you to produce some kind of artifacts, maybe text, maybe code, maybe website, maybe tool, anything, maybe report. But not simply speaking. Brainstorm, but document the result of your brainstorm and publish it. It will be a great result. And next slide, please. We have a very simple work plan. We have about 2 weeks to have preliminary list of teams, and we will have 27th of February. We will have a special session with a report of these teams, with talk of these teams to advertise the projects. And after this, we will have about a month to prepare teams to work. And then we will have one round of Earth spinning, 29th of March. It is very interesting because it will be 24 hours, and for sure you can have convenient time to work to you, but this will work around the globe. And after this, we will report of results of our work in community to community in Ontology Summit Symposium this year. And what I ask you to do now, next slide, 6. you should join discussion on Ontolog Summit list, and you can join our current projects, for example, project of Viktor Agroskin and his team with 15926 editor, or Gary Gercross, Mike Bennett, about developing or revising ontology patterns, or you can suggest your own project and start your discussion on Ontology Summit list, or participate in current discussions that already you have there. And next slide, please, seventh slide. If you have any questions, you can write to any of co-champions of this track, or write directly in discussion list. You can have input on our wiki community input page, and we are waiting you. Have fun. Thank you.
Thank you, Anatoly. So now we move to the open discussion phase. So there's been a lively discussion already on the chat room. If you wish to ask a question, then please raise your hand by clicking on the hand icon on the lower right of the chat room. And we can begin our discussion if you, okay, we have one person. Matthew, please unmute yourself. *7. Matthew, *7.
Can you hear me?
Ah, now I can hear you.
Okay, thanks. Sorry. Finding the dial pad.
Go ahead.
Linux Skype. I was just wondering, I posted it in the chat, but sometimes people aren't always watching the chat. I was wondering if the software that's being developed for either of these projects, I was particularly interested in EOL, for bringing in the structured data and the ontology worlds together, is available up on GitHub or some other open source place.
Would any of the speakers care to comment on this?
So this is Ruth. I know he doesn't really, he's really interested in EOL, but I will say that all of our ontologies and the code we're doing to, you know, take C-grid 3 data and turn it into triples, it is all available on, actually, it's Google Code SS, the SCI project, SSIII. So, yeah, we do that.
Is that link posted somewhere?
Can you post a link on the chat room, say?
Sure.
Nathan, is any of the code available from EOL? Nathan? Nathan, we can't
Nathan,
hear you.
Nathan, you may be muted on your own phone.
You may be muted.
You're not muted.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So, yes, I did thought Anne posted a link. There is a GitHub link. Let me look it up. All of the code for EOL is open source, so it's all available. And let me just grab that.
That's terrific. Thank you, both of you.
So, Eric, do you have anything you can say about availability of these tools?
Well, the availability Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Yes. The availability of they are available through Oracle products like Oracle database support bi-temporal capability. The Oracle database support data cubes using star schema and dimensions and hierarchy. Business intelligence support analytics around data cubes. Enterprise managers support all these models that I described in the metadata repository and dashboards and things like that. And we are building this kids solution on top of these. And so, but the underlying infrastructure is part of the products. So I'm so if that satisfied the question. We don't necessarily have
the ontologies.
Yes.
Are the ontologies going to be available?
Well, we meant this architecture to be used with your own ontology, such as the ontology for ice and snow and life science. You can apply this ontology with kids. With your own data, so it's a solution and not necessarily one application that we are providing.
Can you post a link to the Oracle software where we would find that, please?
Yes. I may not have the right link to provide, but maybe we can. We can send to you later on if you send me an email or whoever is interested, send me an email and I will respond with these links to our products.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions? No one else has their hand up. Leo. Yes, Leo. Can you unmute?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. I just posted, I actually posted it twice, apparently, a question to Eric. I'm not sure what directive is in his slide. I mean, it seemed like that's the next state or process after hypotheses, but before actions and before fact. So I'm not sure what directive actually means in your system.
Yes. So directive and action are two complementary representations. Directive is a data perspective and action or enactment is the knowledge perspective of the same thing. The directive specify a schedule, a plan, a course of action, a recipe, and then the enactment require knowledge, either tested knowledge or automation, or you need to know which specific agent can perform these actions and how to dispatch to these agents. So that enactment knowledge will apply the directive, which is a specification of actions, and apply that on the environment and entities, and then as a result, gather new facts that are then added to the system.
So it's possible then you could retract a hypothesis, in which case you'd have to retract the directive that you had issued?
If you are working with the environment, retraction may be possible, like you add more memory to a component like a JVM, and you later found out that hypothesis was not the best hypothesis, and there are new information leading to different root causes, you can retract the memory from that JVM. So it is possible in a lot of cases.
Okay, because I had confusion. I thought maybe you also had a notion of belief in there, which would be could be overturned by other things.
Yes. So we have cases where knowledge is evolving. So and we tend to use temporal database and temporal calculus. So we will say that, like what Anne had posted in the chat, she talked about data that are available 200 years ago, or data that you can get, they are recorded in the ice, right? You go deeper mm-hmm. in the ice, and you are getting 200-year-old data. And but then in some of these cases, you want to apply the knowledge that you have or analyze the data based on the knowledge you have 20 years ago or 40 years ago versus today. So the provenance allow you to apply different versions of knowledge to different ages of data.
I see. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so is that all, Leo?
Yes, sorry.
Okay, then Michael has
yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I have a question for Ruth. So great presentation, really like that. And I had a question about the slide 10, the kind of the chart of all the different CIS ontologies. I think Gary made a comment in the chat as well. I'd be interested in hearing about some of the challenges that you faced in designing and reusing these different ontologies in a kind of a modular way. Was reusability the biggest issue, or were you doing a lot of the design and then kind of figuring out how to integrate them afterwards?
My personal goal was to make these reusable from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, the WMO folks have agreed to actually maintain these over time. So the biggest challenges turned out to be simple things like how do you do versioning and provenance and things like that within an ontology? Because at the time when we first did this, there's still not that much support for provenance of ontologies themselves in the ontologies. And that wasn't supposed to be the thrust of our research. But anyway, so I worked with the Creative Commons folks to come up with a way that seemed to be sort of, might even work. And so that's what we did there. As for making them small and separable, that was done deliberately because there are different communities involved. As you notice, there's a suite of ontologies that have to do with, the actual physics of sea ice and the terminology around types of ice. And then there's ontologies that are strictly about digital data. And then there's these egg codes, which kind of do the mapping between the two. They're kind of a boundary object between data and physics. And that just fell out naturally from thinking about that. I will say that these ontologies are actually much more well connected than you might expect, because we reused terminologies from W3C type ontologies wherever we could. So like terms like data set and stuff like that are inherited from those kind of ontologies. And we also did as good as we could possibly do to connect to existing ontologies in the earth sciences, for example, SWEET. And actually, we found a couple of issues with SWEET and are still trying to work with that group to get them sorted out. So basically, if you're coming down the SWEET route, get to the cryosphere and finally get to sea ice, you should be able to go straight into using the WMO ontologies pretty much straight away, because it's all connected up.
What about the, you mentioned event calculus. How do you integrate that with the other ontologies?
Oh, well, now you're talking about real research, and I'll probably have a better answer for you next week because we're getting together with Peter Fox, Srijoda, and I, and Peter Pulsifer, the main three people here at NSIDC, to basically work through those issues.
Because there's also this, you know, the process specification language ontology, PSL, which is an ISO standard, and it's a process ontology. You can reason about processes, time, states, et cetera. And it's already written in first order. There's an OWL expeditization that goes along with it. You might be interested in taking a look at that a bit more, too.
Actually, I will let Srijoda know. So PSL, PS, what was the S?
PSL, Process Specification Language. Here, I'll send you an email after, give you some more info.
Okay, that'd be great.
Okay, I think we have time for one more. Bob Morris, you have your hand up?
Yes, thanks. Am I audible?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay. I wanted to go back to one of the things that Nathan talked about because it a little bit poked its head up in some of the chat, and that is some very interesting consequences of taxonomic synonymy. There are some surprises that will make people think that the problems must be interesting. First of all, taxonomic a synonym, the notion of synonymy in taxonomy is never symmetric. It's never symmetric. If A is a synonym of B to a taxonomist, then B is not a synonym of A. So that already should convince people that there's some interesting things going to happen when you try to integrate data. And the underlying problem that Nathan did hint about is that synonymy arises in taxonomic practice because names change all the time and over time. And what's meant by synonymy is an older name. So what you can come to pretty quickly conclusion there is that if you're trying to integrate data that have that are using what sounds like the same name, which sounds like different names, but one of them is actually a synonym for the other, you kind of have to know for authoritative reasoning, you have to know what was the original usage of those two taxonomic names that are in play. If you don't know the date, or specifically, if you don't know what the usage of a particular synonym was in a particular piece of data, you can't tell whether two different data sets, even whether or not they have the same name for a species, whether they're talking about the same thing. There's a little bit of work about how you can reconcile that in ways that are beginning to be put into some of these data application, these data integration applications in an RDF context and in logical reasoning. That's the Euler project at UC Davis, Bertram Ludischer's project, in which they look at the ways based on first-order logic fragments, the ways in which two different taxonomies can be mapped to one another. There are often more than one way, and there are often more than one taxonomy in use in all this data. And those kinds of things probably are closely connected to at least parts of ontology mapping anyway. But it doesn't look like standard notions of synonymy, and they're quite critical to the way the data has to be integrated.
Okay. Nathan, do you have any comment on that?
Hey, Bob.
Hi.
Bob is technically correct. synonymy in the context of taxonomy and nomenclature, biological nomenclature, is a complicated and rich experience. It does present a lot of interesting challenges, and the fact is that from a logical perspective, much of the data and much of the data gathering has not been precise enough to make really strong logical statements, and a lot of it is sort of left to sort of vague human inference, which of course is a nightmare from the perspective of formal semantics and that sort of thing. There certainly are a lot of us thinking about how to do a better job there, what kinds of things we can make, what kinds of things we can do. One of the frustrating things about it is that there are sort of reasonable conclusions that you can draw that are probably true. But of course, we all know that that doesn't mean they really necessarily are true, and that sort of thing. So it's a big rat's nest, really, when you get down to it. And the interesting thing is how to connect things, and the names at least give us an ability to index the information. And I think my expectation is that at some point we will have to really reckon with this problem, and it will probably mean new tools for how we do taxonomy and new traditions, but I expect those may be a generation out. I think the ideas will be developed soon, but it's not something that's going to change fast, and it's going to be hard and painful for a long time.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I know you know that I didn't mean to suggest that what you demonstrated was victim of that particular thing. It's quite, if anything, quite the opposite. But I just think there's a lot of fascinating problems that might appear in data integration, in big data integration problems as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So,
okay, with that, I think it's a good time then to adjourn this session. We've run a little bit over, but it was a really fascinating session. The talks are just marvelous. Thanks to all the speakers and to the audience members. And I believe we should now adjourn. Peter?
Sure. Great session.
Okay.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye now.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you. Thanks to our speakers.
Thank you. Bye-bye.